This is Bloomberg Best.
Bloomberg Best is about the insight and the context that we get from our guests.
It's a great way to catch up on some of the stories you might have missed on the Bloomberg.
Stories you're not going to find in any other news organization.
Bloomberg Best. Bloomberg's best stories of the day. Powered by 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries around the world.
I'm June Grosso. On this edition of Bloomberg Best for Tuesday, June 20th, we talk about the U.S. economy with Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin.
We're just not going to be satisfied with 2% growth. We're going to work every day in this administration to do everything we possibly can to unlock the economic capital.
Plus, former Treasury Chief Larry Summers on trade policy.
The idea that somehow we're doing something dangerous by entering into trade agreements that's going to threaten American workers is really nonsense.
All this and more coming up in the next hour of Bloomberg Best.
Andreas Uddermann is the Chief Executive Officer and Chief Investment Officer at Allianz Global Investors. He talked about the challenge Brexit poses to investors and offered his outlook on the British pound with Bloomberg's Francine Lacroix and Tom Keane.
We've adopted a wait-and-see policy. We've taken the view that there's everything to play for, and fortunately this election result sort of reinforces that view, because there needs to be a broader cross-party consensus in the UK now on the terms of Brexit. To give you an example, our business since the Brexit vote in the UK has grown very significantly. We had 150 employees in the UK a bit over a year ago. We're now at 350. So we're taking a constructive perspective on this, and we'll hope for the best.
What do you measure it with? Is it pound? Is it gilt? Is there an indicator out there that you can actually say, instead of I guess reading blow by blow what happens in negotiations, what do you look at for
the market? Yeah, sterling is definitely an important indicator. I mean, ultimately, the bonds would be as well, gilts would be as well, but since the central banks are in charge of what happens there, I think it's not as good as an indicator, but as sterling is. But I take the view that sterling has probably bottomed out. No. Over the medium term, it should rise.
Do you detect that there is a one-way bet on short sterling?
I don't know if it's one way, but certainly there is a significant bet out there, and I think a lot of people, I think rightly, are very concerned around the outcome of Brexit. But, you know, that's a positive to some degree, because
right.
Clearly politicians are more focused on this now. They see the damage being done to sterling, and therefore, you know, trying to do everything possible to mitigate the impact. I think, for example, the discussions around Brexit that have started yesterday, focusing on what happens to the millions of EU citizens in the UK and vice versa, UK citizens in Europe, I think is an indication that politicians have understood that the uncertainty that's impacting people is ultimately, in the short term, damaging to the economy. Therefore, they need to fix that first.
To be clear here, Andreas, you're going against the grain and you're saying there can be some political stability which will allow for sterling stability. And do I understand even stronger sterling?
I think in the medium term, sterling will be stronger both against the dollar and the euro. I'm very surprised that the relatively positive turn of events following the election has not been reflected at all in sterling, or very, very little. It's pretty much where it was before the election result when we were looking like going for a hard Brexit come what may. That's now off the table, in my opinion. The chances of an accommodation of a long transition period have risen significantly, and that's, in my view, needs to be positive for sterling.
We sometimes tend to forget that this also will have a negative impact on Europeans, right? And this is especially German exporters. How much of a hit will they take if there is no Brexit deal or a messy Brexit?
I think not too much. I think the German exporters in particular have dealt for a protracted period of time with strong currencies and uncertainty towards their export markets. They'll be much more concerned, say, what happens to the US or China. Than the UK, but as I said, I think that, you know, reason will prevail and we'll get a reasonable deal, and that is why we have adopted this wait and see attitude ourselves for our business here in the UK.
And it's, when I look at the equity markets right now, I really want to address the negativity that's out there. I've seen article after article after article doubting this bull market. Explain to our audience on a global basis why equities are high in value. Is it simply because of central bank realities?
Well, it's central bank realities, but it's also arithmetic, isn't it? I mean, if you look at the value of equities, it's the discounted value of future cash flows. Now, long and short rates are very, very low all over the world, and therefore that implies, you know, high equity valuations. In addition to that, over the past 12 to 18 months, we've seen pretty good earnings growth and a lot of buybacks. So that explains why equities are relatively high in valuation terms.
Are equities being supported still by the new religion of return on cash, of dividend growth and share buyback? Is that another core reason for this lift?
That's clearly another core reason. I mean, we've been saying for the last 10 years that dividends were going to become more important in people's mind in terms of how they invest. And actually, if you look at the market in terms of dividend yield, particularly in Europe, but also in the United States, you know, dividend yield valuations don't seem as stretched as PEs or price to cash flows.
Is this a Brexit story or is this purely an inflation story?
I think it's a bit of both. I mean, clearly inflation all over the developed markets has struggled to take hold. Despite relatively low unemployment in the US and in the UK, there is no inflationary pressure, no wage pressure to speak of. A little bit of imported inflation in the UK, so that's why the 30-year rate is still relatively, you know, low, and governments are taking advantage of that.
That was Andreas Uddermann, Chief Executive Officer and Chief Investment Officer at Allianz Global Investors, speaking with Bloomberg's Francine Lacroix and Tom Keane. Coming up, a conversation with Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin. You can see all the Bloomberg Best stories at Best Go. This is Bloomberg. Steven Mnuchin is the U.S. Treasury Secretary. He talks about foreign investment in the U.S., the dollar, and consideration of ultra-long bonds with Bloomberg's David Gura at an investment conference near Washington.
You become familiar with the idiosyncrasies of this town, the strange customs. You're about to become familiar with another. That is the semi-regular debate about the debt limit. When are we going to hit it? How soon is that debate going to happen?
Well, let me just say, we're already having the discussion on it, and I don't think it's a debate. Let me be clear. I think everybody realizes we need to raise the debt ceiling. The government debt is the most important credit in the world, and we're the reserve currency. So this is just a little bit of a process that's the government process of how we go about. And one of the things I think we should think about over time is changing this process. It should be once we've spent the money that the debt limit goes along with the commitment to spend.
Is it the beginning of September when you think we hit that limit? Is it later in the month? Do you have a specific date at this point?
We constantly review these numbers internally. I don't want to give exact projections, as I've said. I've encouraged Congress to act before they leave for the summer, but we do have enough money to get us through September in case they don't.
Back in January, before you were confirmed, you spoke against prioritization of debt payments. Now that you've been on the job, you're familiar with the office and the way things work here in Washington. Do you still feel that way? Are you against prioritization?
Let me just say, I think that the Congress should raise the debt ceiling so that we don't have to talk about prioritization. That's really the focus. We should be paying our bills when they're due, and we shouldn't put the government at risk.
There hasn't been what I would call a chorus of consensus around this issue and a few others within the administration. There are some of your colleagues who are calling for a clean raise of the debt limit. There are others who think it should be tethered to spending cuts. What's it going to take to get to unanimity on this issue and others within the administration?
Well, I think we have a general understanding within the administration, and we're clear on that. And we're working with Congress. This is really up to Congress to raise the debt limit. And again, it's something I'm confident that they'll do before we get to a point that's critical.
On the issue of unanimity, is the White House saying there is a date by which we will have a tax reform proposal from the White House? Are you speaking with one voice on that issue?
Well, I think we've been pretty consistent in saying we're working every week very closely with the House and the Senate to have a joint plan when we come out. And the idea is to get us all on the same page so when we release the combined plan, it's going to get passed. And it's going to get passed by the House and the Senate, and the President will sign it. And it's our focus to get that done this year. It's critical to the economy, and we're working every day to get that done.
What's your relationship like with lawmakers on Capitol Hill? How have you found that, being new to Washington, being new to this job?
I think we have very good relationships, and I think it's a team effort. I think the good news is we understand what we want to do. We want to get growth in this country. We want to have tax reform. It hasn't been done in 30 years. It's critical. We want to simplify personal taxes. We want to create a middle-income tax cut. And we want to make business taxes competitive. We have one of the highest tax rates in the world with worldwide taxes and deferral, which leads to trillions of dollars left offshore.
You bring up growth. I must say that's the theme of this conference. I talk to maybe a half dozen economists every day, and almost without exception, they disagree with the projections that you have, that we can attain 3 or 4% growth in the near to medium term. What are you seeing that they're not?
Well, again, I just want to put this in perspective. When Obama came into office, he was projecting over 4% economic growth. We obviously haven't had that. We've had one of the lowest growth rates in modern history. And we're just not going to be satisfied with 2% growth. We're going to work every day in this administration to do everything we possibly can to unlock the economic capital, to create jobs, to create better wages, and get growth above 3%. We're committed to doing that.
You're here among and talking to foreign investors. Let me ask you about CFIUS. You've said your decisions on foreign investment are based largely on national security. That's the cornerstone. Would you be in favor of an economics benefits test for investment in the U.S.?
Well, let me just say they're not largely on national security. They're completely on national security. And no, I favor CFIUS to be for national security. There's other things we can do to make sure that we are economically competitive. But the U.S. is one of the freest trading markets in the world. It's one of the freest investment markets in the world. We welcome foreign investors to invest here. And we just want to make sure we get treated the same way abroad. That's really our focus.
You've talked about a strong dollar and a dependable dollar. Not to get into the semantics here, but what's the difference between the two? How do you define a dependable dollar?
Well, again, the dollar is the reserve currency of the world. Again, it's not our focus where the dollar is in the short term. There's obviously certain negative aspects of a strong dollar as it relates to our exports. But on the other hand, a strong dollar is a vote of confidence in the U.S. economy and the Trump administration, similarly to what's going on with the stock market. So this is one of the most important economic investment opportunities, the U.S., and we're seeing a lot of attractions here, and that's a lot about what this conference is today.
That was Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin speaking with Bloomberg's David Gura. Coming up, we go from the current Treasury Secretary to the one who served under President Bill Clinton. A conversation with Larry Summers is next. You can see all the Bloomberg Best Stories at Best Go. This is Bloomberg.
This is a Bloomberg Quick Take. Context and background on issues of interest.
Our focus is on the United States' relationship with Cuba, with Bloomberg's Ezra Feaser.
The situation.
Trump has made it clear that he thought that the Obama deal, which reopened channels, both diplomatic and commercial channels with Cuba, was too sweet of a deal for the Cuban government specifically. And he's said that that needs to be dialed back.
The background.
Since the announcement of December 2014 between Presidents Obama and Raul Castro in Cuba, we've seen an increase in travel from the U.S. by 75% from 2015 to 16. And we've seen large interest from U.S. businesses opening channels with Cuban counterparts to do trade and even some direct investment onto the islands.
The argument.
The Cuban-American contingent that is in the United States believes that we should continue to isolate the Castro regime, and those that are for believe that the best way to go is to encourage contact.
For more on Cuba or other quick takes, go to BloombergView.com/quicktake, or for terminal customers, go to NI Quick. I'm Charlie Pellett, Bloomberg Radio.
You're listening to Bloomberg Best on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm June Grosso. Larry Summers served as Treasury Secretary under President Bill Clinton. He's currently President Emeritus and Professor at Harvard University. Summers spoke with Bloomberg's David Westin and Chad Thomas in Berlin.
I want to start with the G20. As we all know, the summit is coming up in just a couple of weeks here in Germany, in Hamburg, and there are considerable differences between the U.S. and Germany on trade. How do you think this is going to play out at the summit?
I don't know. I know how I hope it plays out. I hope there will be a recognition by the Trump administration of the importance of an open global trading system. I hope there will be a recognition of the mutual interest in trade. There's nothing wrong with the art of the deal, but the right and the best deals aren't win-lose, where somebody wins and somebody else loses. They're win-win. And that's what we need to aspire to.
Chancellor Merkel said just this morning that she's hoping that there will be some sort of a deal, a communique out of the summit, but that it's going to be very difficult. What are your expectations?
I'm sure these negotiations won't be easy and they'll go to the last moment. I've negotiated my fair share of communiques, and usually people are up all night before they're released. So this will go down to the wire. I am guardedly optimistic that in the end of the day, reason will out and language will be found that reflects the Trump administration's legitimate concerns about American national interest, but also reflects the rest of the world's concerns with there being a global community. I do think that after the last G7, after the withdrawal from the Paris Agreement, that the Trump administration is on the back foot. And this could be a very important moment for them to send a signal of their different approach, but of a continuing U.S. commitment to global cooperation. I suspect this is a kind of pregnant moment where, in terms of international relations, things could be significantly improved with the right signals from the Trump administration. But if those signals are not forthcoming, a difficult situation could become substantially more difficult.
Larry, it's David Westin back in New York. When you talk about global cooperation, one of the things that's brought to mind is the Paris Accords. And you have an op-ed out with the former Secretary of the State, George Shultz, today in the Washington Post, in which you're proposing a very different approach to basically getting our arms around climate control, and what you call a carbon dividends approach, which sounds a lot like a carbon tax to me. But why do you think that this is doable in the United States today?
Look, I think it's in everybody's interest, because the idea is that by using prices rather than heavy-handed regulation, we address climate change in a way that's better for business. Look, how can a proposal that taxes fossil fuels and is endorsed by Exxon and British Petroleum possibly really be doing great damage to the energy economy? The truth is, it'll help the energy economy by moving away from the kind of command and control regulation that we've relied on for too long. At the same time, this builds in a constituency, because every American is going to share an equal proportion in the revenue and is going to receive a kind of dividend, much like the citizens in Alaska receive a dividend as a result of Alaska's oil wealth. So this is, by creating the dividend, it is providing an entitlement for all Americans that they will value, and it's removing the regulation that's been most worrisome for business. So it seems to me this is very much a win-win approach, and crucially, unlike the current approach, it stands up for U.S. interests through a border adjustment that makes sure that U.S. producers won't be at any kind of competitive disadvantage because of the step we're taking.
That was former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers speaking with Bloomberg's Chad Thomas and David Westin. And coming up, we'll be speaking with Goldman Sachs chief economist Jan Hatzius. You can see all the Bloomberg Best Stories at Best Go. This is Bloomberg.
With the Bloomberg Business of Sports Report, I'm Nathan Hager. Think basketball's all about the shoes? One NBA team's trying on a different accessory. The Minnesota Timberwolves have just cut a 3-year deal with Fitbit, making the fitness tracker the official wearable and official sleep tracker of the T-Wolves, as well as the WNBA's Minnesota Lynx and the D-League affiliate Iowa Wolves. The Fitbit logo will also appear as a jersey patch. That'll be unveiled later this summer. Providence Equity Partners has sold its interest in Major League Soccer media and marketing arm back to the league. People familiar with the accounting say the private equity firm tripled its $150 million investment for a 25% stake in Soccer United Marketing back in 2012. And the Miami Dolphins are trying to expose players to potential career options post-retirement. Inside Radio reports the team recently held a one-day boot camp for players at the studios of their radio and TV broadcast partners. It's part of a broader push by the Dolphins to prepare players for life after any given Sunday. And that's the Bloomberg Business of Sports Report. I'm Nathan Hager.
It's 48 minutes past the hour, and now it's time for Bloomberg View.
I'm Francis Wilkinson, an editor for Bloomberg View. In April, President Trump said that deferred action for childhood arrivals, 2012 Obama program to protect undocumented dreamer immigrants who arrived in the U.S. as children, was a, quote, very difficult subject for me, unquote. It appears Trump was telling the truth. Last week, Trump's administration rescinded a 2014 plan to grant work permits and reprieves from deportation to potentially more than 4 million parents of U.S. citizens and green card holders. The plan had been stymied in court. Supporters of immigration restrictions couldn't help noticing, however, that once again, Trump had failed to strip almost 800,000 Dreamers of the legal protection they had won under Obama. Trump has renewed Dreamer work permits and even issued some new ones. Some immigration advocates suspect Trump fears that rescinding DACA would make political life too difficult for moderate Republicans. Others think it might be something more personal. Trump appears torn between a crude promise made to his political base and what looks very much like presidential pangs of conscience. Imagine that. I'm Francis Wilkinson, an editor for Bloomberg View. For more Bloomberg opinion and commentary, please go to BloombergView.com.
Thank you, Francis. And now let's check in with the Bloomberg affiliates to find out what's happening on the nation's most influential radio stations.
I'm Ed Corey. On WWJ in Detroit, I'm reporting Ford says it'll save $1 billion by canceling plans to build the Ford Focus in Mexico.
I'm Elisa Parenti on WBBM in Chicago. A test of never-frozen quarter pounders for McDonald's is not going well.
I'm Gina Cervetti, and for WBBM in Chicago, I'm reporting that Boeing's vision for the future does not include its iconic 747.
I'm Courtney Dunahoe on KTRH in Houston. Drillers are ready to ramp up spending after 2 years of austerity.
Thank you, Courtney. The Goldman Sachs second annual Leveraged Finance Conference kicks off today in California, and Bloomberg's Alex Steele is at the conference speaking with the bank's most influential leadership. We'll start with an interview with Goldman Sachs chief economist Jan Hatzius, who spoke U.S. Treasury bonds.
There's a question, I think, whether there really is enough natural demand for ultra-long bonds. So I think it's still uncertain whether this is really going to happen. But the basic argument is going to be that it will ultimately, over the long haul, help the U.S. Treasury achieve lower costs.
And you wind up saying that basically it winds up lowering their finance costs. But, I mean, talk about taking some duration risk if you're looking at a 100-year bond. I mean, in your work, what kind of yield do you think would be needed to really compensate risk? We are at a leveraged finance conference, right? So the search for yield is still big.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't really modeled out what the numbers would be. Obviously, the yield curve is quite flat, even between, you know, 10s and 30s. If you look at some other countries that do have ultra-long bond issuance, in some cases, the yield curve bends back down again at very, very long maturities. So you could make an argument that those spreads would be quite low. But the question really is there enough natural demand for having a regular program of issuance? That's typically how the U.S. Treasury has wanted to operate. So I don't think we really know the answer to that yet.
And let's talk about spreads, because you got 5 and 30s. The spread is under 100 basis points. It's the lowest spread we've seen since 2007. When you look at that spread, how do you interpret that?
I think the main one is that the term premium continues to be very low. And I think part of that is Fed policy, the holdings of long-term bonds by the Federal Reserve. Obviously, over time, probably starting in September, October, that is going to be gradually run down. But I think it's still an important factor. And then the other factor is that the inflation risk premium, which I think accounted for most of the sort of steep curve and high term premium situations of the 1980s or 1990s, that's extremely low at this point. And I think that's an important factor. And then maybe a final factor, foreign monetary policy, the fact that the ECB and the BOJ are still running a very easy policy that's, to some degree, pushing investors in those markets into long-duration securities, even in the U.S.
Well, talking about the low rates, we had Rosengren saying earlier that low inflation targets contribute to low rates. And we've heard sort of Janet Yellen not really mention inflation targets, but last week didn't kind of rule it off the table in terms of maybe discussing raising it. What's your thought on that?
I think if you started from scratch and you had to decide between a 2% inflation target and a 3% inflation target, I think you could make a good case that a 3% inflation target would be better. You could say, you know, it doesn't really add that much to the potential, you know, price setting inefficiencies in the economy. It doesn't lead to a deterioration in the price signal to a significant degree. But at the same time, it gives you a little bit more leeway to cut rates in a kind of, you know, economic downturn situation. So I think you could make that case from scratch. Whether you would want to go from a 2% target to a 3% target at this point in time, I think is harder to say. I would be nervous about, you know, trying to let the economy overshoot long-term full employment by a lot in order to get inflation up to 3% at this point in time.
That was Goldman Sachs chief economist Jan Hatzius speaking with Bloomberg's Alex Steele at the Goldman Sachs second annual Leveraged Finance Conference. At the conference, Alex also had the opportunity to speak with Goldman's co-head of investment banking, John Waldron.
Any particular sectors that have more robust demand and issuance versus some that are more closed?
Well, I think the consumer and retail space is an area that people are more cautious, you know, given some of the disruption that's going on broadly across apparel, food. You know, obviously, the Amazon Whole Foods transaction would be a good example where there's real disruption coming across all things consumers. So that's an area I would highlight that where there's more caution around new issuance, particularly in below investment grade credit space. But broadly speaking, most of the other areas across the economy are pretty robust.
I'm glad you brought up Amazon because Goldman was one of the two big banks that led the bridge loan for the deal of Amazon and Whole Foods. Do you think Amazon's going to offer bonds for the deal?
Well, I don't want to speculate on what they're going to do, but we led a bridge loan for them to finance the transaction. And so you could assume that there'll be a takeout of that bridge loan, you know, coming to the marketplace at some point in the near future. A great transaction for them and for us, and we were really privileged to be part of it.
Do you feel like you're going to see more bidders come in? That's kind of the rumor on the street.
I don't really have a comment on that. I think Amazon's a great buyer for Whole Foods. They do a wonderful job with the company. We're very supportive of them. They're a great client of the firm, and you know, we're looking forward to completing the transaction.
Do you feel like big M&A deals are back with Amazon, or was this a one-off?
Well, you know, it's been an interesting environment in M&A. We've seen actually volumes basically flat year over year, kind of year to date 2017. Volume is about $1.5 trillion, which is exactly what the volume was at this point last year. We're still running about 15% below the pace of 2015, which was really an extraordinary year in the merger business. Mm-hmm. 2015 was marked by much more large-scale consolidation in many of the industries that we spent a lot of time in, whether it was pharma, telecom, technology, et cetera. And we haven't really seen as much big deal activity really since 2015. So actually, if you look at the underlying trends in the merger market right now, most of it is being driven by $1 to $5 billion transactions. So volume in $1 to $5 billion transactions is up 35% year to date. Volume in transactions greater than $20 billion is down 40%. So we're really not seeing big deals you know, happening near the rate that we saw in 2015.
Does that change your strategy at all when you have to focus on these smaller mid-sized deals versus the big mega deals?
Our strategy is to be very important to companies, you know, above $1 billion for sure, and even now more increasingly down, you know, down into companies that are $500 million to $1 billion. So we tend to have a very broad footprint. We obviously do really, really well in the bigger transactions and have a significant presence in boardrooms at big multinational yeah. companies. But if you actually look at our merger franchise over the last 20 years, we've had an extraordinary run in that $1 to $5 billion range and you know, really are very comfortable spending a lot of time there.
And you're number one currently for market share in terms of M&A. You have been trying to sort of boost what you do for M&A. It's not just advising on deals anymore. It's also providing the financing like we saw with Amazon and Whole Foods. How big do you want to become in that space?
We've invested a lot in our debt franchise broadly. If you think about the last 15 or 20 years, we've really come a very long way. So we're focused on the flow aspects of investment grade and below investment grade lending and financing. And we've done a very good job boosting both of our lending platforms and our participation in broad flow business. But more recently and more importantly, I would say we've really become a very large player in the acquisition finance arena. We're now one of the couple go-to banks in the world for buy-side acquisition finance. In fact, this year, year-to-date, we're number one in terms of having deployed more bridge loan activity than anybody else in the marketplace. That's not a place that we normally would find ourselves, but we've invested a lot in that franchise and continue to be very focused on it.
That was John Waldron, co-head of investment banking at Goldman Sachs, speaking with Bloomberg's Alex Steele. That's all for this edition of Bloomberg Best. If you have a Bloomberg terminal, you can see all the Bloomberg Best stories at Best Go. Our show is produced by David Sucherman, Clarice Broff, Richard Truman, and Reginald Bazile. I'm June Grosso. This is Bloomberg.